listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which can no longer remember the night when we bought one last glass of the house red with a painting worth $100 million. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Fiona.
So I'm a vignette on a very sad, poignant, and quite beautiful moment in history and in this show for this one.
Well, it's time once more for our annual Celebrity Historical, and this time the celebrity is none other than Richard Curtis, the man who made World War I thigh-slappingly hilarious in Blackadder Goes Forth, and who turned Christmas into an insufferable ordeal in Love Actually. So let's see how he gets on with history's greatest artist, probably, in Vincent and the Doctor.
Also wrote all the Parker and Penelope scenes for that much enjoyed 2003 Thunderbirds movie too, don't you?
Don't hold that against him.
No, they're the best parts of it. They were actually going to do a spin-off. George Harrison loved it so much he was going to do a Parker and Penelope film, but the studios wouldn't pick it up. Damn it. Where were we?
So, Fiona, are you a big fan of Love Actually?
I do enjoy it, but I'm not a big fan, no.
Yeah. I read in preparation for this podcast a hilarious article, which I'll fling in the show notes, about how truly horrific it is and how it's about white middle-class men being entitled around various ladies, including Emma Thompson.
A few other people have said that, but not Emma Thompson.
No.
What did you think of it, Fiona?
Well, at the time I just watched it as a fun movie, but I do think poor Emma, like, that's just the heartbreaking moment in it. I think I always find all the stuff with Hugh Grant a bit tedious. But, yeah, Emma's little sub-story was quite heartbreaking.
If we're talking Richard Curtis films, I much prefer About Time to Love Actually, which is the film that he made just after having written Vincent the Doctor. And it's about a character who discovers that he can travel backwards and forwards in his own timeline.
Ooh.
And so he keeps doing over his life to try and get the, you know, like a life that he's happy with. And in the end,
in the end, he joins the First Order and betrays them to the Resistance.
He becomes Ginger Hitler. Yeah. And surprise, surprise, Bill Nye is in it.
Yeah. So did he do The Tall Guy? So Emma Thompson and Jeff Goldblum. I think it's a sort of it's a very early Richard Curtis thing, and it includes a superb kind of take on how awful Rowan Atkinson is as a person, played by actual Rowan Atkinson, which I thought was pretty brave. So it's pretty good. He is a strange choice as a Doctor Who writer, I think.
Well, it worked, so...
We did have this earlier in the season where we had Simon Nye writing Amy's Choice, you know, someone who's new to Doctor Who and wasn't necessarily a sort of Doctor Who-ish kind of writer. And I think that it means that the show does things that it might not otherwise do. And, you know, it's something that Russell had tried to do. You know, there was always that sort of Stephen Fry script that was going to happen in Russell's but Moffat actually brings it off here, and I think it's sort of super successful.
I think also possibly the reason why it's successful is because Richard Curtis had this idea many years before. And
how much of it was the idea? Because didn't Moffat rewrite a lot of the monster stuff?
He came to him with the idea.
Okay.
For like, well, you know, like the basic idea, like Vincent and the Doctor. From memory, a lot of the dialogue was rewritten, and he asked Moffat to be quite brutally honest, and Moffat was his quote. Yeah.
And then he never came back. I think, I mean, there is Richard Curtis-y dialogue and there's a Richard Curtis-y sort of sensibility. There's a sort of, there's an upper middle classness to its concerns, I think. So we're in an art gallery in Paris.
If only we were in that art gallery in Paris. It's one of my favorite art galleries in the world.
Except there's no, the Van Gogh room looks nothing like that octahedron, but. I love the Musée d'Orsay.
They could have gone to Amsterdam.
Yeah. Gail Landy redid it. It's a beautiful early 19th century train station, the Musée d'Orsay. It's just a beautiful space. And they are actually in it when they're running around looking up at the roof, but then they run away to a studio with populated by Bill Nighy as queen of the art world.
You said they're not outside it, though.
No, that's no, green screen.
Yeah.
So they did, I think they sent a second unit to their... to do the sort of, you know, establishing gallery shots and things.
Yeah.
But most of it is the National Museum in Cardiff.
Ah, okay. Which they've used over and over again.
That's what it is then, and it works so well because the establishing shots are of the roof, and I just, my, you know, your brain reads that as, oh, yeah, you're actually in there because there are stairs like the one that they walk up to with the black statue. Yeah, okay,
it's clever. Beautiful, isn't it?
Mm. Very clever.
Yeah, it's quite well done, I think. And then the rest of it's shot in Tregear as part of the block where they do Vampires of Venice. So the village.
It was very exciting to be back in Port Merion. I expected to see old Sly Boots running about with his gold mask and headless chickens. There was a lot about chickens again.
Chickens
in these stories. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, how do we feel about Van Gogh just personally?
It's a perfect placement for what's happened with Amy and Rory. And I think it actually touches very lightly on the depth of the man. Obviously, because it's family TV, you can't go too much. Tony Curran does a beautiful job, but we are doing the accents, aren't we?
I do love that sort of lampshading.
Yeah.
Oh, you're Dutch like me.
Yes. It really peeves me. I don't know what Fiona thinks about it. I'd like to know, but I look. Maybe it's because I grew up with RP and I just remember everyone. But there's a reason RP was required is because you don't have to turn on the subtitles, which I have to do for Karen.
Really?
Because they throw their lines away. I have to do it for Matt too.
Young people, they mumble.
Yeah.
Well. I don't have that issue at all. I find them both very easy to understand. The only actor I have had a problem with in the past was really Sylvester, and that was a case of getting your ear in, and then once you kind of got used to him, it was okay. But initially there was a lot of lines that, and I guess too, like because we watched, it's not just a single viewing for a lot of episodes, so you might miss it on the first go and get it on the second go and
the 10th go. And
but yeah, with Karen, I've never had a problem, and it's same with Matt. But that's something that's never really occurred to me.
I think the issue I have with Matt's dialogue is not the inability to understand his accent, but how fast he speaks.
Yeah, I mean, he has a sort of tendency to throw lines away. But, I mean, I think the decision to let Tony Curran use his own accent's the right one because we've seen actors struggle with kind of accents. And I know that, you know, British actors do accents. They're very good at it. But it also kind of gives him a kind of earthiness or something, you know, like that. There's a sort of strange quality to Vincent as he's portrayed here. Because even though he's an artist, I don't know, there's something about the rough way that he lives, how excluded he is, you know, how different he is from everyone else, you know, the way he's treated.
Mm. And have you ever heard an Antwerp accent?
I think too, in a Doctor Who context, it's the last thing that you really care about. Like, you just, it wasn't until until he had the line where saying, oh, are you Dutch as well, it actually hadn't occurred to me. It just, I'd just been watching the story and enjoying it. So yeah, I hadn't even sort of thought, oh, he's not speaking in a Dutch accent, because I think you're so used to going to alien planets and everybody speaks in English in received pronunciation. You, you just English. Sort of, I think that's the last thing that really I was sort of looking for. I was just so engrossed in the story at that by that point. So probably if it had been a feature film, you might have said, well, hey, but I think in a Doctor Who where it's more about just let's have a fun story, I think it's fine.
And we first see him actually in that scene in the cafe, and that cafe is actually something that he paints. It's actually
a very famous painting, yeah. And it's beautifully realised. Yeah. Did you get that too, Fiona? And it's the same with the set of his bedroom. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah, and that was one of the joys of the whole episode.
Most of that cafe was built on location by the production team. They found something that looked about right, but they built the awning, they built the platform, they found the right chairs, they did the right, they changed the windows of the cafe, and lit it like to be picture perfect.
I think that the decision to like recreate a bunch of the paintings, you know, like they recreate the straw hat self-portrait, they recreate that church, they find a church for him to paint. Like, I think that's a pretty good decision, but it does, there's a sort of theme park approach to this, like there is to every historical.
I think it starts that way, but because of the subject matter.
Yeah.
They, you know, like they do start doing the shtick, the, oh, look, wow, sunflowers. It's kind of veering towards the same sort of, what I think are mistakes in things like Shakespeare Code. I don't like that approach to history in a Doctor Who story. But when they start to delve into his depression and his isolation, and then they have those beautiful scenes with him noticing that Amy is sad and she's crying without realizing it.
Oh, I love that scene.
Then it becomes something more, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the bedroom was somewhere else entirely. He'd been painting sunflowers for some years. You know, that cafe was in Arles, you know, just north of Paris. Like they collapse his history a bit, but you know, there's a reasonable amount of actual concrete information about his life, and some of it's delivered in that first speech, the Bill Nye speech in the first scene, where we just get a little bit of a summary for the children at home of why Vincent's important.
I think that's because Curtis, although he was already familiar with Van Gogh quite a lot, he still went and read a 200-page biography of him in preparation, which is more work than he's done for a lot of his own films.
Yes.
So he probably had a lot of that at his fingertips.
Yeah, yeah.
So just it was a bit like a Van Gogh 101, but just with my own children, who at the time they were about sort of roughly 10 and 8, and they wouldn't have had, you know, a detailed knowledge of who he was, but it just piqued their interest, so that they did, after watching it, they did want to know more. And 5 years later, I was actually fortunate enough to take them to the UK, and we went to the National Gallery, and they were super interested to see his paintings. And I've actually got a really cute photo of Cameron next to the sunflowers, which is beautiful. And yeah, and he was like really keen to get his photo taken with the, of course it didn't say for Amy on the real version. we did check.
That's disappointing.
How did they react emotionally? Because this is some really, this is big stuff. But
yes.
I have a great faith in children's understanding that far more fluidly and far more directly than we do as adults. And I'm really interested in what a 10 and 8-year olds who've been brought up, I imagine, although, you know, I don't know what you're like with your horses, but I imagine to be honest and speak their truth. I know you've got discipline is also required. But do you, how did they respond? Were they You get the blunt truth out of children, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely do. But to be honest, it's just so long ago when we did that initial viewing that I can't recall, and I was probably too busy sobbing my eyes out to really care what they were thinking at the time, because I was
proper sob one, isn't it? I hadn't sobbed since RTD and Rose leaving, you know, that with, as I did with this one.
I had a little cry this morning when I was rewatching it in preparation for the podcast. I was crying for the last sort of 10 minutes of the episode.
I did cry yesterday. It's
Doctor Who fulfilling its educational remit.
Yeah.
In a way that is not banging you over the head.
I think that the decision, in fact, to ignore, sort of to collapse a lot of the stuff into that last sort of 6 months of Vincent's life is the right decision, because you get to show the important things. You know, like sunflowers are introduced, that scene with Amy with all the sunflowers outside for breakfast on that day.
And then he punctures her sort of excitement by saying, oh, I don't really like them.
Yeah, how they're quite disgusting.
Yeah, but I think that that's Curtis then getting the chance to actually do a reading of why he chose those flowers, you know, that he finds them disgusting. They are on the border of life and death. There's something earthy about them.
They fascinated him.
Yeah.
More so than that he was in love with their beauty. He was painting a life, painting of a flower, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that was worth doing, just to get those images in and to get that stuff talked about. And the fact that he'd painted heaps of sunflowers, you know, in Paris and whatever in Arles years before doesn't actually matter. And anyone who's sufficiently motivated to learn about Vincent from watching the episode will go back and you know, find out kind of what the deal was. So I thought that the Shakespeare Code fell down a bit because it didn't engage with any of Shakespeare's concerns at all and just basically was doing the shtick and dumping the quotes in. But I think this does do
and
that.
And it was quite different from what we know about the real Shakespeare. It was kind of like that rock star version, whereas this is trying to adhere more closely to reality. But you're not feeling the whole way through that you're being slapped around the head by it, whereas it's not like a massive info dump and you're not being – you don't feel like you're having history rammed down your throat. And the whole sunflower scene was worth doing just for the fact that visually it was beautiful, like that Amy in her red with all the yellow and the bright sunshine. I mean, that's a gorgeous image.
And her smiling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just beautiful.
Is that before or after he says about this? I think that's just before they go for the walk and he said, why you're crying, why are you so sad? And that's the nice contrast to that as well. I just think that was a really important scene.
Yeah. I mean, I think that scene is unusual because it's the only one that really touches on the arc. You know, it could be the Doctor and any companion, really. And Amy, you know, she's sexually confident and she's red-haired and stuff like that. So she sort of fits in.
And she wants to have lots of babies.
But it's the only one that's about the Amy and Rory
arc. Just remember, I've got red hair, okay?
Hi, Fiona.
I don't want to have lots of babies. Two is plenty.
But, I mean, that's the only scene that touches on the wider arc. And so last week Rory dies and we get a little hint, don't we, where Amy is suspicious of the Doctor because the Doctor's being so nice to her and taking her to the gallery. And then we get this where she's crying, and it's actually going to be incredibly important because this is sort of paving the way to the idea that memory is important. And we'll talk more about that. We're kind of getting ahead of ourselves, but we'll talk more about that in the finale. But I don't think we can not remark on it. It just touches very lightly on the arc and contributes to it very slightly.
But it's clever too, because it's one that if you had just watching this as a one-off and you didn't know that Rory had died, it wouldn't be like a massive jar. Yeah, you wouldn't be going like, You'd be going, oh, there must have been something happened, but it doesn't really detract from your overall enjoyment of the episode. It's not kind of like you had to previously have watched all these episodes to be able to follow what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's probably a function of getting someone big like Richard Curtis in. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to sit down and map out the minutiae of the season to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's another bit about you not feeling like you're being slapped around the head with stuff. And later where he just sort of says, like, he just says Rory, you know, again, that's quite subtle, really. It's not kind of doesn't make – it's just gentle reminder to the audience and going, oh, he's not here. So if you're a viewer like us, you sort of go, oh, Rory. But for if you weren't watching, you would just go, oh, yeah, whatever, Rory. You know, you wouldn't be – it wouldn't be a big distraction. Yeah. So, yeah. And I just love, too, that sort of subtle body language where when Vincent is talking to Amy and they're walking along and they're obviously having, like, a very emotional moment and the doctor is just looking more and more uncomfortable and guilty in the background and he sort of, you know, I think he says something along like, oh, moving on now, you know, just, but yeah, just the look on his face where he's just going, oh, we don't want to go here kind of thing. And at the start where you said about too, in the gallery where, about the whole, oh, you're being so nice to me. I just think that says wonders about their relationship as well, the fact that they've got that slightly bickering and it's like, it's weird, you're being really nice to me, like what's going on? Do you want, you know, normally like what do you want kind of thing. And again, like when sort of she's not looking at him, you can see him sort of just looking that little bit uncomfortable. But the whole body language between them and the whole like, on-screen chemistry is wonderful between the two of them. I think they really do work well together.
You know the Starry Night scene?
Oh, yes.
Where they're lying there. And like, we can talk about that in more depth, but they're physical closeness, you know, they're all holding hands and all three of them together, like there's a kind of physical warmth between Matt and Vincent as well.
Yeah.
You know, the holding hands thing is not awkward in any way, but the three of them are lying there and they're really, really physically close to one another.
Yeah.
There is something very sweet and sad about how close Vincent becomes to the doctor. There's a really, really good moment, I think, where he says, you know, we've fought monsters together to the doctor, but on my own, I don't think I'll do quite so well.
Yeah.
That I think works terrifically well. Yeah.
The other thing I think is really special is that line where after the monster has accidentally been slain, that there's so much compassion for starters for the whole death of the monster. It's not just like, oh, oops, we, you know, sorry, monster, you're dead, which does happen in a lot of episodes. It's kind of like, you know, somebody casually dies and it's like, oh, well, moving on. But there's so much compassion from all the characters and that whole line of sometimes winning doesn't I'm not quoting it directly, but
it's
the whole
not fun.
It's not fun to win.
Yeah.
You know, you've won, but it doesn't feel good. Yeah. And I think that sort of is a bit with the whole Vincent's thing as well. You know, that just like not everything is good in life. There are these painful moments that we all go through.
Have they even won? I think is the question there. They haven't won. Nobody's won out of that situation. This poor animal who was in pain and lonely and blind and you know, was, you know, lashing out because it was scared.
Yeah,
that lashing, that actually, that was the first part rewatching it that I started to cry because that whole line of Vincent's about like, oh, it was lashing out and that's what how the kids treat me and throw stones at me because they don't understand and... Yeah, lashing out because you're hurting. So sad.
I think that monster's really interesting don't you? I think there's something symbolically about it.
About Birdie Num-Nums. It's very Peter Sellers. Well, it's also very Monty Python, isn't it? It's actually, no, it's very Spike Milligan. Do you remember Spike Milligan's drawings of enormous parrots in profile in his children's book of Milliganimals and Silly Verse for Kids?
I think it's only Monty Python at the end of that scene when once it's died.
But
this is a dead parrot.
So in some way, it and its race represent the human race, that we're cruel and brutal and we abandon, you know, hurt members or members that can't keep up and just leave them to suffer. And that's what's happened to Vincent, and Vincent makes that comparison himself.
So the Crepheus are Tories.
They're human beings. We all do it. Also, I think that the blindness of the Crepheus, you know, the Crepheus, which is lashing out at people and is blind and is explicitly compared to the people persecuting Vincent, it has one less sense than we do. And there is something about Vincent's ability to see that this episode kind of plays with.
Yeah. But also, do you think that the because you know how the doctor does have a line saying that they're really vicious and they're killers, and that's why we need to stop this monster, because it will just, you know, go around the village and kill everybody indiscriminately. But then, and obviously that girl, and it's wonderful how it is off camera, because obviously she was very, very brutally murdered. And the reaction of the doctor to that is, and Amy, all the characters, it's great, because he's not just like, oh, there's a dead body. Like, he, you can see that he's genuinely going, oh, this is awful, and this poor girl. Like, he's feeling genuine remorse that this has happened. But do you think it was a case of, like, she was in the way, so he, the monster did kill her, or she literally was in the way and he didn't see her and accidentally, like, crushed her? Or because we're not quite sure whether she's been ripped apart or just kind of stepped on and squashed or something.
Isn't there a line about it picking off the weak?
I don't remember, but there is a line. I mean, I think it is brutal, and that's why I've kind of resisted any reading that sees the monster as Vincent himself, because although there's
brutal.
A sense in which, no, so there's a tendency for the Crepheus to abandon their weak, and so that makes us think of Vincent, but I don't think you can read the monster as Vincent just because of the monster's cruelty.
Yeah.
But the monster does give Vincent something to identify with, and the reason that Vincent can see it, I think, is because he's also abandoned and excluded in some way.
Yeah, very much so. The dualities of the id monster, because we're back to Forbidden Planet and the Tempest. Oh, there's a lot of Shakespeare in this, actually.
More so than the Shakespeare code.
Yeah, much more so. But, yeah, because we're talking about fraught emotions and people working off each other. But, yes, the center of this is actually Amy. In fact, most of this season, I wonder how deliberate it is of Stephen Moffat to make Amy the center of every story, much as Rose was in that season one. This is another Amy story, and it's Amy's fraughtness. So we have the Doctor being her. Oh, we're back to Sex and the City, of the four girls being actually the four positions of the ego, the four positions of the consciousness. Yeah. So we've got the Doctor as Amy's superego, in control but not. We've got Vincent as her broken heart, and then we've got the id monster as how she's actually feeling. And then they're all just playing out. So she always ends up being Samantha, of course, but just playing out. But just playing out the you know, maybe that's why this is powerful. I wonder if Curtis was thinking along those lines. I'd like to think he was, because there isn't a better cipher for a story like this than the absolute beauty and tragedy. The beauty and the pain of an artist who paints their own impossibility to live, the impossibility of dealing with this much emotion in every painting. That's why he's worked. He's, you know, you could say, critics would say technically he's not the greatest of the impressionists. He doesn't have the structure of the formalism. He doesn't, it's so fast. It's all intuitive painting. But that's why people respond to it.
It has the most heart.
Most heart, exactly, and the most expression. There is no filter. It is how he feels. And children pick up on that. You said your children were young teenagers when they were completely drawn to his work in London. It's this, I think everyone feels that, everyone who is in touch with their own feelings. So that's why it's the strongest episode for me of the season, and perhaps for a very long time. And really, Bill Nye is therefore the voice of the conscious narrator in this, just by his presence and his meter. And then there's that moment in the end where his childhood hero, he gets to hug, and then the conscious adult self has to step in because we have to stay in control. And the same thing happens with Amy. She ends up having to stay in control.
So there's that beautiful moment in the gallery when the doctor asks Dr. Black, Bill Nye's character, to describe how important, like, Vincent is in history, and he describes him, and it just focuses on Vincent sort of feeling all these emotions. Then he goes to hug him and thank him, and then they walk off back to the TARDIS, and Dr. Black kind of has a moment of oh, and then he goes, no, and walks off. It's just beautiful.
I actually think, too, Richard Curtis is funny and writes comedies, and I think that that's properly funny as well. Like, that scene risks being overwrought, I think. The pop song and the whole kind of thing. Like, I think it does risk being overwrought, but I fall for it every time. Like, it still works. And he undercuts it because remember that Amy, when she says goodbye to Vincent for the first time, tells him to trim his beard before he goes to kiss someone. And then Vincent comes forward into the future and kisses Bill Nye twice and then says, sorry about the beard. And then just that wonderful moment where Bill Nye thinks, oh, my God, I've just met Vincent, and then goes, no, you know, I'm a serious grown-up. Obviously, that can't possibly have happened. But, again, it's sort of played for laughs.
And he kind of has that sway on his feet where he's sort of like, whoa, you know, as he walks off.
You know, this episode, Curtis wanted to call it The Eyes That See the Darkness.
Right.
Which
is a terrible title.
It is a terrible title.
Also very descriptive of it. It describes what happens in the story. You know, he sees the darkness in the creature, and he sees, you know, the light and dark in the world.
So there is one thing that kind of that annoys me a little bit about it, which is that, and maybe it works, like, I don't know enough about Vincent's life to know exactly what actually happens here, but just that sort of constant, the trope of the struggling artist, you know, one of the ways that we justify our own sort of poor treatment of artists is to suggest that all true art comes through sort of struggle or something like that.
And pain and being poor.
Yeah, that's right. And so that sort of insistence that what Vincent is doing is turning his pain into beauty and stuff, like, yeah, okay. It does seem like a simplistic reading of what's going on, or an appeal to those tropes. And that's just one of the things that I just find slightly, you know, slightly off-putting about it. But I do think that the way that it handles his illness is really interesting and thoughtful, like really good.
I think it's still the only Doctor Who story to ever have a helpline message.
Oh, at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because they mentioned killing himself twice, and I think they may have had to do it
Like, I think legally you're obliged.
Yeah. There's a moment at the very, very end where Amy is disappointed that they didn't do any good. They didn't make a difference.
Oh, that scene.
It's so beautiful, isn't it? Because it's what the doctor says when he's hugging her. And it's you know, Matt is super awkward and can't tell if someone's pregnant and like is super weird. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he looks like he doesn't understand people. But that speech about a life being a pile of good things and bad things and them not cancelling one another out, and look, we didn't fix his mental illness and we were never going to, but we made his life a little better for a bit. I think that's lovely. You know, that's terrific.
It's
and the
gorgeous.
Other thing is where and the other thing is where he kneels down before Vincent and starts to talk depression. You know, depression is a very complicated thing. And Vincent just says, shut up, I'm trying to work, which I think is wonderful.
That's brilliant. I love that. But that's that whole thing of balancing the darkness with the comedy side. Like, it's just that lovely little balance.
Yeah.
How, like James said earlier, in the scenes with Dr. Black, how there's great emotion in there, but there's also just those little touches of humor as well. And the whole, you know, looking like when he walked off and his glasses are falling off his face and he's slightly looking like he's had a bit to drink. But his line, he said as well, like he said, like the most beloved. And I think that whole thing of Vincent feeling that he didn't have much love in his life, you know, he was shunned, and now he's got somebody saying, well, people did love you, you were loved, and you are special. And yeah, that's sort of what really on the viewing yesterday really sort of struck me. And the bit with you know, that Nathan was talking about with the doctor and Amy, where he's comforting her, like he doesn't hug her, he actually like gets in and has a cuddle. Like he's really, it's not just a whole token, I'm going to stick my arms around you. It's really like about comforting her and really trying to make her feel better. And he still does have that little bit of like kind of geeky awkwardness, but it's at the same time, it's just so compassionate and just such a wonderful thing to say. And if you do that whole game, like let's stick another doctor in the story, like could you imagine like that working with another doctor? I think Tom would just kind of try and leave the room as soon as possible, or maybe like just give her a dirty hanky or a pile of jelly babies and then try and like get away as quickly as
possible. Tom could have done it. Yeah, Tom could have done it. Pat could have done it.
Yeah, but I mean, he wasn't really even a hugger, let alone a cuddler.
Sylve.
Yeah, Sylve, I think, could have pulled.
This would work as a Sylve story perfectly.
Yeah, that's not a bad take. I think, you know, like what I was thinking of recently was in Can You Hear Me, in the Jodie episode, where Graham tries to speak to her about his feelings around possible recurrence of his cancer, and she wanders off and says, I'm going to go and play with some controls here on the TARDIS.
That really annoys me.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, you can be.
That drives me nuts.
Yeah, yeah, but I thought you can be geeky and awkward, but, you know, actually
care.
Yeah, be wise. You know, like the doctor is old, and even though he can't tell if someone's pregnant or how old people are or whatever, he's still wise, you know, and so it's nice for him to be able to say something, you know, just something perfect. I think that speech is incredibly good.
No, absolutely. And I think that was, I don't want to concentrate on Jodie in this episode, but that was a perfect opportunity to just kind of humanize her. And because geeks are still people, as we all know, because I put my hand up to being a geek. And they still have emotions, and they still care and feel compassion and all these big emotions. And harking back to what Richard was saying about like how would children react to watching this episode, the whole thing about being excluded, I mean, there's not many children who, you know, even at that younger age, who can't relate to that feeling of being an outsider and having people exclude them, and how horrible a feeling that is. And I mean, everybody would have been through that to some degree in their life and knows what it feels like. So I think that probably would be a level where children could have jumped on board. They might not understand, you know, the big feelings of depression and all that, but they would understand that feeling of people not wanting to be your friend or include you or talk to you, or, you know, not fitting in. So, yeah, that probably is a clever slant on on the whole depression and madness. And as the I love that the doctor said, "You're not mad," as well. There's that line at the church, "You're not mad," when he starts to do the serious conversation about depression, and then he's like, "Bugger off, I'm working," kind of thing.
I like to call that Matt-splaining.
Yeah.
Can I tell a Vincent story?
Yes, please.
So I have been to Amsterdam a couple of times where there's the Van Gogh Museum.
Love that museum.
Yeah. Ooh. And I've been there twice. And the second time I was by myself, and it was 2008. Calvin was at home and I was traveling on my own. And I spent the day just wandering around the museum and looking at as much as I could and reading, obviously, the biographical material that was available to contextualize each of the paintings. And I think the collection is actually organized by location, you know, like the period of time, when's he in Arles, when's he in Auvers, when is he, you know, in Paris and so on. And I spoke to Calvin afterwards and he asked me how I was. And I said that I was feeling sad. And he said, why? And I said, because. And like, this is, what, 2 years before this episode comes out? And it was because of that barrier in time. That means that after your death, you no longer have the opportunity to discover what your reception is going to be like. And so the very fact that he died without ever imagining that anyone would care anything about his paintings or even remember who he was, you know, that he had sold one painting in his lifetime and now there were art galleries just full of his paintings and they were super famous and beloved. And it properly made me sad. And so that final scene is absurdly over the top wish fulfillment. It doesn't really belong in the Doctor Who universe at all, in a way. The episode's over. They're walking back to the TARDIS. They've said goodbye to Vincent. And the Doctor just says, oh, no, screw it. Let's fix this terrible injustice and bring him forward. And you know, all of that stuff about time and, you know, like not violating the laws of time and all of that. Who cares? I'm Richard Curtis. I don't give a crap about your stupid science fiction rules.
Yeah.
I'm just doing something that should have been done, that should have been possible. And I think that that's why I cry in that final scene. And, you know, like Curran's performance is so good, like so brilliant in it. It's just tremendous. It's over the top and schmaltzy and indefensible in all sorts of ways, but I can't possibly hate it. I think it's magnificent.
It is magnificent.
I don't even know why we would need to say schmaltzy. It's truth.
Yeah. Not a big fan of the song.
Well, the song is perhaps a little over the top, but I don't find that it detracts from the emotion of the scene. I don't think it really adds anything either. I don't think you need the song. But the emotion of the scene speaks for itself, and I've said a number of times to the people in this room and on the phone, I love this story more than practically any other Doctor Who story in history. It's not perfect, but it's the emotional core of it that makes me love it so much.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up, you know, with a mother who was obsessed with Vincent.
Right.
And, wow.
And so, you know, had that artwork, you know, like prints of it on the walls around the house and, you know, coffee table books with them. Like, I love Vincent.
Yeah.
I also was at that museum in 2008 in Amsterdam, not at the same time as Nathan. And it was just such a moving experience because of what that man meant. I knew his history at that point. As an adult, I knew what, you know, what he'd gone through.
Yeah.
And
And knowing that sort of loneliness and depression, pain, and that he'd created such beautiful artwork was just like, that was beautiful to me. Like it was really moving experience.
And it doesn't need to be perfect as well. You'd, like James just said, like, oh, it's not perfect. Well, does it need to be perfect if you absolutely loved watching it? Like, does it need to be perfect? So for James, it was perfect, because it's like he absolutely loves it. And I mean, so do I. And I think anybody who disagrees is really just not my friend, quite frankly.
And there's the title of the episode.
I wonder how well it sits.
No, I think it all does. The comedy with the tragedy. You see, we lost a friend, a very close friend last year. Making light of suicide really, even in a narrative form, sits awkwardly with anyone who's lost anyone in their family, regardless of how they've lost them. But I do feel this works, A, because, as you said earlier, Fiona, Doctor Who takes everything out of the situation and puts it into Doctor Whodom.
Yeah.
So it exists under its own exigencies. But I don't find the depth in the tragedy of his loss. I find it in the tragedy of his not recognizing his own brilliance while he was here. And that is where the emotional truth lies in this. And again, it's the mirror of Amy not realizing why she feels lost, or not realizing that love that she didn't allow really herself to express to the person she was committed to and who gave her an absolutely open heart. And in return, she was still playing the alpha. She was still playing big and playing strong. But this is the episode where we get to explore what that is like and how truth is actually much, much vaster. It really is a field of corn waiting to ripen, or a field of wheat waiting to be harvested. So the metaphors are very strong. I suspect Curtis is such a good writer that he thought about all of this. But it's like any analysis of any work, whether it be writing or music or painting. It's already there. All the critic does, all the observer does is unpick it. But there's a lot more in it than we could even say. We're just touching on the emotional aspects and the construction of when it's a good piece of work, it all comes together perfectly. So I suspect we could spend a lot of time unpicking this and finding metaphors for the truth of life.
That's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week to drop round to James Corden's place to ruin his life in the Lodger. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger and Jodie into Terror. Until next time, let's hope that we've all remembered to give our beards a trim the next time we give you a big kiss. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Does that make Fiona our beard for this one?
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, James Selwood, Richard Stone and Fiona Tomney. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Balancing the Darkness, was recorded on the 14th of February 2021 and released on the 16th of May. Thank you to everyone who's written in to say that they'd love to arrange for me to wake up to a garden full of sunflowers. They do give me hives and hay fever, though, so I will appreciate the gesture, but you will be sneezed on.
What do you think? I think we've probably got an out.
Fiona, what do you think?
Oh.
You don't have to add anything if you don't have anything to add.
I did think of something earlier.
Yeah, because you're the person here with children.
One of them fortunately walked in the door quite quietly earlier after a big night out on the town. So how time has progressed.
That was the sound that Nathan noticed.
No, that was the dog, the sound that Nathan noticed.
My favourite bit, which we haven't mentioned, this is probably a tag, is him bitching about Michelangelo and Picasso.
Oh, yes.
It's so funny.
Yes, and Gainsborough's a proper painter.
Yes, yeah.
And then we got the doctor is a little bit of a wine and cheeser with his mates down at the posh club.
That is funny, isn't it?
Like, it's a very Pertwee thing to say.
Yeah. The whole thing is about, you know, Vincent being the greatest painting ever, and the doctor himself says it later on.
Mm.
But when he's by himself in the TARDIS, he wants something much more representational and something with a little bit more sort of painterly skill.
We found Joshua Reynolds missing. We know that.
So funny.
You know,
but
he would.
Like the Picasso being a ghastly old goat, which I think is very mild, actually, compared to what he was doing. Really like.
Like two eyes. Center of the face.
And Michelangelo being a whinger. And it's so shocking, too, because whenever the doctor does that sort of name-dropping stuff, normally it's, you know, I knew Houdini or, you know, like I was great friends with Da Vinci or whatever. But it's not I met them and they were just intolerable. It's so funny. And he's so bored as well. Like, I love how bored he is in that scene. He's just terrific. I love it when he's sort of bored and shocked.
Yeah, and that comes in later with the power of, was it? What's the episode? Is it the power of
three?
Yeah. How he just kind of goes and paints a fence and mows a lawn, and which is, it's a lovely like part of Matt. That whole how he's got that real restless energy. Like he's somebody you can't. And even this. Just thinking back to the Vampires of Venice. That I'm not sure if you've recorded that or not, but there's a bit where he sits in that throne. And he doesn't just sit down in the chair. He sits there and he kind of squirms himself in and gets comfy. And, he's sort of somebody who's in perpetual motion. He's never just a standing there doing nothing kind of guy. He's got all that.
I love that physicality.
So do I. That is one of the things I love about his doctor. Yeah, and the floppy hair, that doesn't go stray either.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And I love the way he says the word important. Do you listen? It's my favourite thing about his performances when he says important.
Say that again.
It's great.
Oh.
He says important.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. Yes.
The vowels are very...
Yes. It's the T. It's the proper T's and all of that. He says it like a posh kid, but I still like it. All right.
Love it.
I think we'll wind it up. I'm going to do the thing, and again, it's good night, and then James, and then Fiona, and then Richard.
Yeah, done.
Well, dear listener, that's all we have time for this week.